We live in a me first society. I am the most important person in this room, and I'm sure you. And if you don't believe me that we live in a me first society, you obviously haven't been driving on the highways very much. Don't we see it there? This piece of space on the road right now belongs to me, and no one better take that place. And you're driving along real nice and patiently like a good citizen, and next thing, people are swerving in front of you and braking in front of you. And being the humble soul that you are, that you never apply your hand to that horn. Just yesterday, I was at an intersection in Rogers, and I know the cycle on the lights is very quick. It's only 10, 15 seconds, and they'll move you along real quickly. It's at an intersection on the highway. And I was in a real hurry to get home, to really do nothing. But this person in front of me was on their cell phone, and they made me miss a whole cycle. And I felt absolutely justified in applying my hand to that horn, because I really was the most important person. I probably lost at least 20 seconds. Our subject for today is worldliness, godliness. And our verses are James 4, verses 1 through 7. And I'm just going to read the first two verses right now. What causes fights and quarrels amongst you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire, but do not have, so you kill. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. At the beginning of the last century, there was a theologian who started thinking about his philosophical views of the world. And he came up with this new school of thought, or school of philosophy, that really changed and started making changes to the way that we view the world, and the way the world has changed and what we believe today. Basically, this philosophy began, his thinking began with, what do we know? And it begins very innocently. What do we know? And we know this, that I exist. And how do I know I exist? Because I'm pretty good friends with myself, and I know who I am. Pretty benign, seems like a good place to start. But then he goes beyond that and says, any coercion that comes from the externals is really wrong, because that's depriving me of my individual freedoms. So anything that you come along and your teachings, the way you feel about life, you shouldn't influence me. That's destroying who I am. And then he goes on even further. And if you want a name for this, it's called existentialism, a big name which really is, meaningless. But it even goes even further that actions are really amoral. What you do doesn't really mean that you're good or bad. It's simply you're acting out on who you are. This is who I am, and this is the way that I act. and really is your expression as an individual. And so, you think of any action. So the action that takes place is amoral. It's not right or wrong. Meaning of life comes from within in one's actions. So you essentially become your own meaning for life. Subjectivity is more important than objectivity. Facts are to be interpreted the way you want to interpret those facts. Its primary virtue is authenticity. You have to be authentic to yourself. And that's the word they use profoundly and profusely. Authenticity. Am I true to myself? The influence of this, the growth of this particular thinking especially began to grow immediately after the Second World War when philosophers were beginning to think about right and wrong, and when they looked at what Hitler had done. So how do we know what is right or wrong? And the importance of that, and they began to realize that if Hitler had not had more of this thinking, he would allow other people to have that thinking as well and not try and impose his will on other people. So that's the way the theory goes. However, that influence of that thinking has profoundly influenced everything that happens in the world today. It has influenced theology. It has influenced psychology. It has influenced arts and drama, literature, psychology, I mentioned already. Our thinking has changed pretty dramatically over the last century, much more than what we realize. And a lot of that can be shown by, especially during the early 60s, for those who can remember the early 60s, the hippie generation. What was the hippie generation all about? It was your actions, my actions and the way I think are important, and my authenticity to myself is important, and I can express my authenticity by wearing my tie-dyed shirts and or even going naked, or and you have to accept me because that I'm being true to myself. Got into the arts. I mean, if you look at Picasso's art, and this is a term that was interesting about this particular. It's more than a generation because it has influenced society over multiple generations, really. I've told you many times, but I was brought up in a city along the coast, and there was a lot of my school friends were surfers, and they used to use some mind altering substances, and hey dude man, and one of the expressions they used to use is, do you get it? And you look at a Picasso painting, and they say, man, hey, dude, man, do you get it? And you say to yourself, get what? That sort of looks like a face looking which direction? That was actually very important in this teaching. You get it. And that term was, do you get it? How many people do you have heard of John Cage and his famous composition called 4:33? He's a musician, composer, famous, really famous, and it was well known during that time period. 4:33. I actually went onto YouTube last night just to watch a recital of 4:33. And I actually looked at several pianists performing this. And The one that I enjoyed the most was the pianist came in there. He sat down at the piano, lifted his hands. There was a stopwatch on the piano over there. Grabbed the stopwatch, closed the lid to the piano, hit the stopwatch, and for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, sat and did nothing. And then at the end of 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and everybody cheered. Great performance. Did you get it? Right? Yeah, but that influence came from this existential thinking. It is the abstract is far more important than the objective, than what you see. Anybody heard of Roald Dahl? I thought you would. Have you read his stories? Did you get them? As a kid? Yeah, he probably published more kid stories than anybody else. Famous child author. I had to go dig back in these things in my mind. It's like, man, I forgot about a lot of these things in my mind. But very, very, very abstract stories. Almost like the Cat in the Hat type stories. You know, but he was even more abstract, right? I mean, you come to the end of these short stories and you say, okay, I don't know if I get it, but that's what happened. So what impact has this had on society? We are seeing it. This particular thinking has profoundly influenced the way we see society. And we see it every single day, and I just mentioned it. The me society has even become greater than, I mean, we always have been a me society. Let's be honest, we sinful human beings. We always consider ourselves the most important person in our lives. Whether you want to admit it, and if you're honest, you will admit it, that you are the most important person in your life. I came home yesterday, I attended a two-day in-house sort of seminar, summit they called it. And I came home and because we participated, we were given a prize. And I loved that, you know. And so they gave us chocolate bars and goodies and bar, you know. It was really, I came home and I said, look what I brought. So my wife says, oh man, that's going to go right in my stash. You know, and it's like, that was mine. No, what's yours is mine. And I'm the most important person in this house. So actually, some of the stuff we begin to see is pretty serious, really. So if you're going to apply for a job at New York City, in the city of New York, when it comes down to gender identification, how many options do you think would be on that application form? 10? Yeah. Actually, you're getting close. I checked last night. 31. 31. And in our day, I hate to say in our day, how many choices did you have? Two. And we probably could identify each other by simply looking. Okay, I can see that you're female and that you're male and female and male. 31. But it comes out of this thinking. It's because it's not what you think or who you think I am, but who I say I am and how I want to be identified. And so if you don't identify me or don't recognize the way I identify me, you're a racist, you know, homophobe, misogynist, I mean, all those Nazi, even fascist. I mean, you hear those terms thrown around quite a bit nowadays. And I'm trying my best to stay out of politics here, because right now in the world, politics is a very sensitive and delicate subject. But this is the reality of the situation. We're dealing with people who are very sensitive about these things and want other people to recognize who they are. I was recently watching a YouTube video of this girl. It was a young girl. I'm not even sure how it got there. I was actually looking for some political stuff, but then this video, you know, YouTube pops up these ridiculous. And this woman, she comes on this video and she said, "How am I going to convince the world as to who I am?" There's a massive problem with this. And there's a practical problem with this. I mean, forget about the politics and all that type of stuff. How does the world adapt to one individual and twist around this one individual? And then the next person has to do that and the twist around that one individual. And we have this, everybody wanting to be recognized as the most important person. And we've seen this, absolutely seen this in society. Another effect of this is no winners and no losers. We don't have winners. Winners are somewhat bad. You know, the most important thing is participation. Are you participating? And it doesn't matter how you participate. Participation might be that I've just arrived. I'm just simply there. And really, the most serious problem that we've probably seen, and it's really manifesting itself at the moment, is the inability to accept loss. Because all their lives, especially the newer generation, their parents have made sure that they've got everything that they wanted. It's not what they needed, it's what they wanted. And so, always, if you throw a tantrum, you're going to get what you need. In fact, with some kids just saying, I want this, and their parents gave it to them. And we look at the recent elections, and you look at the violence that has occurred because people, the results of the elections weren't the way people wanted them to be. As I was preparing for this over the last couple of weeks, I read the newspapers every day. I'm a bit of a news junkie. And as headlines started popping up, I just sort of grabbed them and thought, okay, this is a good illustration of what we've seen in the world today. Mark, I don't have a list, so if you can just bring up that first one. They're sort of random. I'm trusting Mark over here. Read that. You cannot. In the UK, the National Health Service has put out a communication that you cannot use the term pregnant mothers anymore, because this is offensive to some people. They're pregnant people, or persons, sorry. People are even incorrect. They're pregnant persons. And this actually came out of a sort of a serious situation, in that there was this woman who was going, she was actually changing her gender from female to male, and during that transition she got pregnant. And so now they're claiming that the first male pregnancy in the United Kingdom, and that came out of that. Next headline. This is really not a headline. I had to go find it. Great value colleges. These are 20 great value colleges that have safe spaces. So who here knows what safe spaces are in a college? Who knows what microaggression is? Microaggression? a chuckle over here. So obviously we know what microaggression is. So microaggression is if I consider myself to be a bisexual leaning male, which is one of the gender identities in New York City. So a bisexual leaning male, that's who I am. And you say anything negative about that, that's a microaggression. You've been aggressive against me. And that might hurt my feelings. And I might cry about that. And so in the colleges, and this is not a joke, I'm being very serious. This is happening. And in fact, I didn't list all the colleges that was on that list, but there are colleges like even Harvard now has safe spaces, Boston College, even in the Midwest, Kansas State University, Kansas University, Boulder, all have safe spaces. And the safe spaces actually have coloring books, crayons, couches, and you can go into these places and go color in your little book to bring peace upon your soul because someone has been aggressive against you. To me it's humorous, but it really is serious because this is really what's happening. This is reality. This is really what's happening in the world. Next one, Mark. Yeah, I mean, this is pretty common sense. Italian priests facing the defrocking because he organized orgies in his church or in the church property. And he organized trips with swingers, or if you know what swingers are, I'm not even going to define that phrase or that term. How does a man of God, a man who teaches who God truly is, get to the place where he's organizing those type of things especially on church property? It doesn't matter what the denomination is. Next one. This is a classic. And I think this is really illustrates the point real well about absolutes. There's no more absolutes in the world. Madeleine Albright, if you know who she was Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, in the Bill Clinton administration. She was raised Catholic, became an Episcopalian, and she later found somebody else, I remember reading the story, found out that her family were Jewish, and I believe she was actually Croatian. She came from Croatia. And now, because of what's happening in the world, what Trump is trying to do in the world, she's now decided that she's going to classify herself as a Muslim. So you can change from day to day as to what religious affiliation you want to be. And you have to accept that. It's important that you accept that. Are there any more, Mark? Is there one more? Yeah. This is a funny one, actually. So Jerry Seinfeld actually has an online show, and he often invites other comedians onto the show. It's called, what is the name of that show again? It's called Jerry. Can you work it? Yeah, it's. There we go. Comedians in Car Getting Coffee. So basically, what he does, the show is he gets into the car with another comedian, go to a coffee place, and they drive around and they just crack jokes. I don't know if anybody has seen the show. Apparently, it's pretty funny. I've never seen it. But he had this guy, his name was something Black. I forget his name. Lewis Black. Lewis Black? Do you know him? Is he pretty well? Okay, so he okay, so, but he was on the show. So Jerry Seinfeld tweeted out, Black Lives Matter. There was a massive backlash on this because how can you insult the Black Lives Matter movement? I found that one funny. Sorry, I was a little insensitive about that one. But anyway, some of the stuff is hilarious, but it's really serious because the world has moved away from objective opinions to more subjective and who I am and the importance of me. It's moved away from absolutes. So how do we know what is truth? It's actually an interesting question, and it is a whole discipline in philosophy that actually studies truth and how do you gain truth and knowledge. And if you want a name, it's called epistemology. And at the beginnings of epistemology, the thinking was that you gain truth by experience. So I've experienced things in life, and if certain things happen, I know that that is good or bad. There's epistemology, and it's not a bad way of thinking, really. I mean, if you cross a road, you know that you need to look in both directions, otherwise a car could hit you. And experience tells you that. You might have seen it happen. You might have seen someone tell you about that. There's some form of experience that happens from that. However, there's a bit of a fault with that type of thinking. And the thinking, it goes something like this. I know for a fact I'm going for an interview. And there's two of us that are competing for the job. Sue and I are competing for this job. We both interview, and then I find out another fact, that the person that has $23 in their pocket is going to get the job. Okay, I know it's a nonsensical, but it's just a random, another fact that has appeared. Someone told me that, as a fact, that if you have $23 in your wallet, you're going to get that job. And I know that Sue, because I was looking, she was counting the money this morning. She had $23. I saw her. She had $23 in her pocket. And so I came to the obvious conclusion from experience. I knew, I saw the facts, that she was going to get the job because she had that $23 in her pocket. What I didn't know, and I truly never know this, how much money I have in my own wallet. Because my wife puts the money in my wallet. My wife does everything for me. And I get the job. And I open my wallet and I look. And lo and behold, I have $23 in my pocket as well. So the point, all I'm trying to illustrate here is that we can have all the facts. And all the facts that we have could be absolutely right. It doesn't mean that the results are going to be the same. And so if you apply that to religious thinking or theology, how do we know what we believe is right? And I've thought about that many years, actually. Because that's a big debate in the epistemology society. How do we know what is truth? How do I know what I believe is truth? I've come up with this solution. And I'm not sure if I'm 100% right. But I think I am. So what has been the experience of other people that have traveled the same road? What do they believe? And what have been the results of what they believed? And I think one of the things that we have seen for two centuries now, that the teachings of Jesus Christ has been lived by millions and millions of people. And if they live that life, there are good things that come out of that. Not necessarily rewards, but definitely the quality of life. What they believe, the joy that they experience, regardless of the condition they're in. They know that Jesus is their Savior. We also, and then the question comes up, what about hardship? How does hardship fit into this thing? When I was in we call it primary school, elementary school, we had this PE teacher. We call it PT, but yeah, you call it PE, so I'll go along with PE. Our PE teacher, his name was Mr. Nunley. He was a smallish type of guy. He was an interesting character. He was actually a bomber pilot during the Second World War. Flew many sorties from England to over Germany. He was tough. He was a tough guy. But he loved kids. He genuinely loved to be with teaching kids, but didn't take any nonsense. And one of his favorite sayings, and believe this or not, this is, and I think about this today, and I just think, oh my goodness, imagine a teacher saying this. We had PE classes twice a week, and during the summer we had swimming as one of our activities. We actually had a pool at the school. It wasn't a very large pool. It was 25 meters by about 10 meters. But it was a big enough pool for training. And it was a training pool. And when you came to PE, of course, there was always some kids who had to have an excuse as to why they couldn't go take part in the activities for the day. So he used to say, okay, all you sick, lame, and lazy, come and sit next to the fence and give me your excuse letters from your parents. Imagine saying that. Okay, you're sick, lame, and lazy. It just so happened in my class, I had two friends. I had many friends. Well, I didn't have many friends. I was an introvert, but I did have two friends. I actually had two friends. One of them was Michael Ewer, and the other one was Vivian Johnson. And there was another guy in my class, his name was Gordon Springfield. We were in school all through school, but he really wasn't in school because he was far removed from where I was. He was a little guy. I mean, and the absolute epitome of a nerd. Absolute epitome of a nerd. And for swimming, we used to actually have a uniform. So we wore a uniform, and we had this little black bathing suit with a little white stripe down the side, you know. And Gordon, he was as white as a lily, skinny as a little rail like this. I mean, just imagine this little, you know, bent over shoulders, you know, he pulled his little bathing suit, you know, up to his belly button over here, you know, sort of, you know, almost, what is that TV program? Urkel. In fact, when I first saw Urkel, it reminded me a lot of Gordon. But his brain power was way beyond my capabilities. I mean, this guy was absolutely brilliant and really a nice guy, but it was just, he was on a different level. So I had no idea how to associate with Gordon. One of the problems that Gordon had was he was absolutely petrified of water. And I remember when we first, I think we started swimming lessons in second or third grade. I think it was second grade, actually. Coming to his first PE swimming lesson. And he came walking in there, you know, with his little, and you could see, I mean, he was visibly shaking. I remember this so well. I mean, the poor little guy, I actually felt sorry for him. And because I was one of the butchers. I was one of the guys who got to the deep end of the pool immediately. You know, I was athletic. I'd spent hours. I mean, I was brought up on the beach. He was not. And Mr. Nunley looked at him, and he knew immediately that, okay, we have a challenge. We're going to have a challenge with this kid. And he said to him, Gordon, I want you to sit at the end of the pool and just put your feet in the water. And the rest of us got in the pool, and the pool had rails around it. You could grab onto the rails, you know. And, of course, you had to learn how to kick, you know. So everybody grabs a rail, and you kick your little legs, you know, like this. And then said, okay, everybody put their head underneath the water, you know, and you learn to swim correctly, you know, sort of kicking in and, you know, learning to breathe, you know, in the water. And there's Gordon on the end of the pool kicking his little legs. Michael Ewer, him and I we lived in the same neighborhood. I remember coming to school one Monday morning. Why did I get emotional? This is a long time ago. And the teacher saying, Michael was in an accident yesterday. Sunday afternoon, his parents had friends and family over just for tea. And he was eager to show his friends what he had found in the cabinet next to his father's bed. He had found a revolver. And he took the revolver and he was playing with it. It was a pure accident. And he shot himself through the neck. And it was a .22, so it wasn't a high caliber. But the bullet was lodged right against his spine. Miss Langley was my second grade. That was second grade. I remember it well. She was our second grade teacher, and she was in tears. And they said they weren't sure of his condition or whether he was going to survive. Michael, he did. He was in ICU for many months, not months. He was weeks in ICU, and then they put him on the floor with all the other kids. And I remember visiting him. The hospital was right across the road from the bus stop. There's no school busing in South Africa. You had to take whatever transportation you use. And I used to ride the public buses. And the bus stop was about, half a mile from the school, real close by, but directly across the road from the hospital. And imagine this, parents. Here I am, a second grader, coming home from school every day, and it was usually about a 30-minute wait for the bus. So I used to pop into the hospital by myself, second grader, walking from school, with my little bag, my little cap on, my little black and white uniform, walking and go visiting Michael every day, and I saw his progression getting stronger and stronger. Eventually, he got back to school several months later. It took him months to get back to school. First PE class, Mr. Nunley. Okay, sick, lame, and lazy. What's your excuse? Because Michael was way too weak to participate in the activities. And of course, Mr. Nunley, he knew that. I mean, and all the kids used to go sit next to the fence, and they sat there for the lesson, and then, after the lesson, they went back. Vivian Johnson, my other friend, he had polio. He had polio he could breathe by himself. I mean, his lung function was normal, but he had affected all four of his limbs. So he had braces. We call them calipers in those days. I don't know if they still call them. But he had braces and those crutches that sort of go around your arms like this. And you could always hear him. I mean, it's a creak all over the place, I remember for the first couple of years he was not able to participate in the swimming lessons or even any other the PT lessons. He just wasn't functional enough. And of course he had to go sit where all the other sick, lame, and lazy people were. And then about a year later, Vivian decided that he would like to start swimming in the pool. And those kids, they did swim a lot. In fact, a lot of his physical therapy was in the pool. But the activity in the swimming pool with us was a little too heavy for him. But he decided that he was going to participate in the swimming pool. And I remember Mr. Nunley, the sick, lame, and lazy teacher, helping Vivian get undressed and then dressed into taking his braces off, putting his little bathing suit out on. He couldn't walk without his calipers, and picking him up and putting him in the pool. And he grabbed onto those. I remember him trying to grab onto those little railings and trying to kick his legs, and wasn't too successful at first. But eventually he got stronger and stronger. I remember little Gordon, Mr. Nunley, eventually got him into the pool and got him to come down to chin level, and then actually got him to put his face in that water. And this took years. This wasn't months. And I remember him actually putting his hands on those rails and kicking and learning how to breathe in the water. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. And I remember the first time that Gordon was able to swim across that pool on his own power. And all the cheering that he got from his classmates. I remember the first time that Michael Ewer got into that pool and how he struggled to gain his strength. He was partially paralyzed. In fact, his left hand was, he had no function with it, but he could walk on his own without unassisted. And I remember him flopping across the pool like this, swimming this type of action. But he got across that pool, and I remember the cheers of him being able to get across that pool. I remember the first time Vivian swam across that pool by himself with his polio. So what's my point? Here's my point. Absolutes matter. They are factual things that happen in this world. But bad things happen to good people. But we have a Savior. We have a God who's prepared to take you with all your weaknesses, with all your absolutes, with all the factual things that you know about yourself, and he's prepared to work with you. As hard as he appears to be sometimes, his true goal is to get you across that pool. And sometimes that is very, very hard work. What we see in the world today are people who have not learned to deal with life. And God's promise to us is, I will teach you to deal with life. An incredible God. And so in closing, I would like to read verses 6 and 8. But he gives us more grace. That is why Scripture says, God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. Submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Father, it's so difficult not to think about ourselves. But I pray that you teach us to look up to Jesus. May we recognize him as our Savior, a God. the most important person in the room. I pray in your loving name. Amen.